We think it was quite natural, indeed, an inspiration, that for the baccalaureate sermon last night, Dr. W.R. Cullum should be chosen, and we were richly blessed by his inspiring message. And in selecting Dr. Hubert Poteet to give the commencement address this afternoon, it is a rare privilege indeed to introduce him to you, though I suspect all of you in this room already know him well. Dr. Hubert McNeil Poteet was born in Wake Forest, December 12, 1886. The son of Dr. William Lewis Poteet and Emma Jane Purefoy Poteet. His father, the distinguished and greatly beloved teacher and scientist, became instructor in biology in Wake Forest College in 1877 and later professor of biology. He was president of Wake Forest College from 1905 to 1927. So Dr. Hubert Poteet was bred and born in the finest Wake Forest atmosphere and tradition. It is therefore not surprising that he loved this school so dearly. His father was associated with Wake Forest College 61 years. When Dr. Hubert retires this fall, he will have been associated with Wake Forest College as student and teacher for 54 years. Thus, father and son will have a combined record of 115 years of association in service with this school. Dr. Hubert Poteet graduated from Wake Forest College with a BA degree in 1906, and 2 years later received a Master of Arts degree here. He went on from Wake Forest College to Columbia University in New York to pursue graduate study, and while there, he was Drexler Fellow in Classical Philology. He earned his PhD degree from Columbia University in 1912. From 1912 to the present time, he has been professor of the Latin language and literature here at Wake Forest College. For 22 years of that time, he served as a member of the faculty at Columbia University in the regular summer school, teaching Latin. During these years, many challenging opportunities have come to him to accept positions of prominence, prestige, and great increase in remuneration at some of the best colleges and universities in our country, both north and south. Several attempts have been made also to lure him away from the teaching ministry into the field of college and university administration. To all of these calls, he replied with a courteous but positive decision to stay with Wake Forest College. Here was his heart. Here also was his mind. Heart, mind, and body were dedicated to Wake Forest College. During his student days, he was brilliant in classwork and versatile in student activities. He and the late Elliot Earnshaw brought the Southern Intercollegiate Tennis Championship to Wake Forest College in 1907. For many years after becoming a member of the faculty, he was director of the college orchestra, sustaining the reputation of being able to play with rare skill every instrument in the orchestra. He was also director of the college choir and organist and director of the Baptist Church in Wake Forest. For 40 years, he was organist and choir director in the Wake Forest Baptist Church. He has also been active through the years in fraternity and Masonic affairs. He is past the imperial potentate of the Shrine of North America, the highest position in that organization. He's also been a leader in Phi Beta Kappa, Congressman Delta Kappa, and a member of the American Philological Society and the English Philological Society. Through the years, he has been a tireless worker in the research area of teaching and scholarship and has produced 8 important books. On the basis of his work as an author, as well as a scholar and master in the field of teaching, he is recognized today as one of the leading Latin scholars of our generation in the entire English-speaking world. Thus, as brilliant and profound scholar, as charming and effective teacher, as eloquent and popular lecturer, as musician, particularly in performances and organs, and as the personification of the Wake Forest spirit at its best, Hubert McNeil Poteet has brought to his alma mater honorable distinction and prestige. It is my honor and privilege to present him now for the commencement address. Dr. Pusey.
Ladies and gentlemen, it goes without saying that no two colleges are alike. In spite of all the accrediting force and their esoteric psychoanalytical mathematics, in spite of standardized systems of grading, honors courses, quality points, minimum hours for graduation, fixed number of working days, in spite of the practice of dividing students into the categories of elders, younger, wise fools, and newcomers, or seniors, juniors, sophomores, and freshmen, if you prefer the more orthodox terminology. In spite of omnipresent and omniscient faculty advisors, in spite of literary societies, fraternities, athletics, and dozens of other such activities and organizations to be found on every campus, in spite of all these matters and many others which will occur to you, in the more fundamental consideration, no two educational institutions are alike. By more fundamental considerations, let us understand, for example, the character of the instruction offered, faculty ability, student honor, alumni loyalty and support, physical equipment, and the level of intelligence and culture attained by graduates. Every respectable college in America was founded for the perpetuation of certain ideals. That is to say, in the ardent hope that its matriculates would eventually go out into the world well prepared to make some definite and positive contribution to society. Those wise and good men who, 122 years ago, lighted a little candle in the forest of waste had their hopes, dreams, and ideals, too. And I wonder sometimes whether, as they turn their glances downward from the eternal heights, they smile with approval at what they see here, or frown with displeasure. I like to believe, and I do believe, that they are pleased with us and that they rejoice as they look back to those early days of struggle and hardship and review the steady and sturdy progress the college has made as the revolving years have passed. Now, really, I was not among those present on that historic day of February, 1834, but I was born there soon after, near the edge of the campus, and except for inconsiderable intervals, I have been here ever since. I therefore presume to suggest to you that there seem to me to be four foundation stones upon which this institution rests and has always rested. To discuss each briefly, and to urge every member of the class of 56 to see to it that these same stones are well and truly laid as the foundation of his and her individual life. Well, let us plant our first stone. Hard, solid work. This institution throughout its history has refused to indulge in the fripperies, frills and father-alls of educational moonshine, so characteristic of much collegiate theory and practice. And on the contrary, it has always insisted on the primacy of the liberal arts as the indispensable heart of its course of study, the very lifeblood of its existence, and on unremitting toil in their service. It seems to me profoundly symbolic and significant that during the early days, students were required to perform a certain amount of manual labor in addition to the preparation of their classroom assignments. The spirit, though not the practice, is still with us, and accounts, I believe, for the iron that gets into the souls of so many of the men and women who go from these halls into the strife and turmoil of the world. To be sure, there has always been a fully organized chapter of the Amalgamated Sons of Rest on our campus. And whether or not I was a my student days, is strictly none of your business. But that ancient order, as you well know, has never represented the spirit of Wake Forest. An honored New England institution of learning has a most interesting song, which alleges that Eleazar Wheelock was a very pious man who went into the wilderness to teach the Indians. That's the way they pronounce it. It goes on to say that Eleazar eventually founded Dartmouth College, that the first student to matriculate was the big chief of the Wahoo Wah, and that Eleazar was the faculty, and the whole curriculum was 500 gallons of New England rum. The best of Wake Forest men and women know, and have always known, that Mount Parnassus towers high, and that the steps that lead to its mighty and majestic crest are many and steep and arduous, and they have applied themselves to the climb with a dogged determination and a flaming zeal that never wavers, nor falters, nor fails. The second foundation stone is the open mind, the firm conviction that it is every man's duty to seek the truth, and when it has been found, to interpret it according to the best light he has, and that no man has any right to express an opinion on any subject until he has examined the evidence. It would seem that Baptists ought to be freer from the blasting blight of bigotry than any other religious group, since the Baptist position rests not upon any formal creed, but upon three fundamental propositions. One, the lordship of Christ. Two, the supreme authority of the scriptures. And three, the complete and absolute competence of every human soul in the sight of God. Actually, however, we have in our Baptist ranks more than our share of bigots. Now, these bigots are forever shouting that they stand on the whole Bible. They do nothing of the sort. Here, for example, are three verses which either they have forgotten or which they blindly and habitually flout. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Judge not that ye be not judged. Who art thou that judgest another man's servant? To his own master he standeth or falleth. I have never known a dyed-in-the-wool heresy hunter who had any respect whatever for the truth. I mean truth as distinguished from distortion, misrepresentation, and downright falsehood. And these heresy hunters are potent and noisy, and very busy at their ugly task of sowing dissension and strife among brethren, and thus of delaying the coming of the kingdom. Moreover, they have always had, and now have, their scouts and sleuths and spies in the college student's body, armed with little notebooks in which they diligently scribble comments on the utterances of their professors, that they may presently pass them on to our self-appointed Baptist Pope, cardinals, and bishops. This address will be promptly and incorrectly reported. And the result will be interesting and striking. Our aforesaid popes, cardinals, and bishops will forthwith put on their war paint and feathers, and with loud and savage hoofs hit the trail. Object my professorial scalp. Now, all Baptists accept the first of the three fundamentals already mentioned, namely the lordship of Christ. But as touching the second, the supreme authority of the Bible, our bigots always demand the right to enforce their interpretation on their brethren. And thus they nullify and destroy, root and crash, the third fundamental, to wit the right of every man to seek and to find what appears to him to be the truth without dictation from anybody. Wake Forest College has always been, is now, and I pray will always be, true to all three of these great fundamentals. Wake Forest College subscribes heartily to the words of Thomas Jefferson. I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility to every form of tyranny over the human mind. And so the bigots and the heresy hunters don't like Wake Forest College and lose no opportunity of blackening its name and fame. I do wish our publicists would stop boasting that we Baptists are a peculiar people. As applied to many of us, the statement is so perfectly obvious as to require no elaboration whatever. But in spite of the bigots and the heresy on us, this college has always preached and lived a joyous hospitality to truth, no matter from what source it comes. An uncompromising refusal to form final judgments until all the evidence is in, and a steadfast willingness to accord to others the unfettered right to their opinions, no matter how widely they may differ from ours. Let us now lay our third foundation stone, faith. There have been many definitions of faith. For example, the late Henry L. Mencken, certainly an agnostic, probably an atheist, once called faith an illogical belief in an improbable occurrence. There are other definitions I like better. For instance, my father, a deep-lying capacity to apprehend the eternal world and to respond to its appeal. Here is another. The light by which men may walk when the way is too dark for sight. And another. The inner perception of unseen reality. And the best of all from the Epistle to the Hebrews in the superb translation of the Revised Standard Version. Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. College men and women of this generation have grown up under a system of education which lives and breathes on tests and measurements, surveys and projects, graphs and curves, charts and statistics. Most of them have had that personality integrated, whatever in the sweet name of Allah that mystic and potent phrase signifies. Many of them have served as animated laboratory material for prying supervisors and eager PhD chasers. Thousands of them have dutifully filled in questionnaires for expert tabulation by their teachers, and especially by the teachers of their teachers. Pi r squared plus H2SO4 plus the square described upon the hypotenuse of a right angle triangle equals your ambition, aspiration, intelligence. Oh no, it only equals confusion, worse confounded. These pseudo-scientific monkey shines have consumed a vast deal of time and effort and a staggering amount of money, and they have left in the minds and hearts of youth a profound and disturbing respect for the sacrosanctity of pencil, ruled paper, and percentage tables. The whole wretched pupil business reminds me of Brewer Rabbit in one of the Uncle Remus stories. The critters decided they'd want to build him a house. And so they got together plenty of lumber and bricks and nails and tools and started a building. Brer Rabbit, he took and got him a squaw and hung it over his arm. And he took and stuck a pencil behind his ear. And here he went all around the house measuring and marking. Measuring and marking. And folks wind down the big road allowed Brer Rabbit doing more work than the whole kit and fire of them. But bless your soul, honey, Brer Rabbit might just as well have been a laying off in the shade, a scratching the fleas off. He wasn't doing nothing whilst the rest of them critters built the house. Moreover, during the past 3 decades, a heavy emphasis has been laid on science at all educational levels. Boys and girls have learned the importance of analysis and synthesis, of detailed reports on observations, of unassailable proof. Thus, the study of real science, which has produced unnumbered excellent results, has united with constant exposure to pseudoscience already mentioned, to develop and foster in our young people a conviction that nothing is real, nothing desirable, nothing even tolerable, which cannot be presented in a graph, examined through a microscope and duly described and classified, or subjected to the scrutiny and evaluation of the chemist or the physicist. Listen to this blazing passage from the second chapter of the book of Zechariah. I lifted up mine eyes again and looked, and behold, a man with a measuring line in his hand. Then said I, whither goest thou? And he said unto me, to measure Jerusalem, to see what is the breadth thereof, and what is the length thereof. And behold, the angel that talked with me went forth, and another angel went out to meet him, and said unto him, run, speak to this young man, saying, Jerusalem shall be inhabited as towns without walls, for the multitude of men and cattle therein. For I, saith the Lord, will be to her a wall of fire round about, and will be the glory in the midst of her. In other words, you can't measure Jerusalem. No, and neither can you compress George Washington into a chemical formula, nor weigh Abraham Lincoln, nor compute Robert E. Lee, nor put Martin Luther into a test tube, nor set up an equation for Jesus of Nazareth. If those who founded and who have guided this college over the years had not been men of faith, there would be no Wake Forest today. And if you, members of the graduating class, ever relax your grip upon your faith, you are lost indeed. Do not confuse faith with belief. Belief is a state of mind at which you arrive as a result of proof. Faith, expressed in the simplest possible terms, is a willingness to accept as true what can never be proved. And many wise men, including Tennyson, have reminded us that nothing that is really worth proving can ever be proved. The Apostle Paul, summarizing Plato's sublime doctrine of ideas, writes to the Corinthians, "For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal." All of you know, before I mention it, the name of the fourth foundation stone, the Lordship of Christ. We are mortal, and so we are prone to err. We falter and fail. We stray from the path our feet have tread. We lag so far behind in the line of march that often we lose sight of the captain of our salvation as he goes on before. But for all our character, indifference, and failures, we here at Wake Forest have always, through all the years, believed that Christ must forever be the directing, animating spirit of all our striving. That our first and highest duty is to follow where he leads. That he is the only hope of the world. And today, graduates, your last day on this beloved campus, I beg you to consider the radiant figure of the man of Nazareth. I do not mean read what some half-flitting commentator says about him. I do not mean pore over the dismal logomachies of the theologians. I do not mean hearken to the endless babble of the interpreters. I do mean press through this chattering mob to the master himself and listen to his eternal words of light and life. He founded no system of theology. He propounded no syllogism. He offered his hearers no mysterious metaphysics. He preferred to kindle torches for stumbling feet, to speak comfort to the weary and heavy laden, to present to a confused and troubled world the love and the mercy of God. And today he requires your allegiance, not your argument, your consecrated and devoted talent, not your orthodoxy. Your heart, not your creed. The four foundation stones I have attempted to present and to discuss are already firmly in place on the new Winston-Salem campus. And so long as they remain fixed and immovable, the old college will march on steadily to ever-widening fields of service and achievement. And so will you, young ladies and gentlemen, so long as your own life rest steadfast and secure upon these self-stained stones. Dear old Wake Forest, thine is a noble name. Thine is a glorious fame, constant and true. We give thee of our praise, adore thine ancient days. Sing thee our humble lays, mother so dear. Dear old Wake Forest, mystic thy name to cheer. Be thou our guardian year for ere day. We bow before thy shrine, thy brow with vase and wine. All honor now be thine, mother, today. And so, members of the class of 56, and you, my colleagues, soon to depart from this hallowed ground, hail!